Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome back to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle, sorry.
Just got a swallow in there.
I was
having a drink.
I tried to wait a little bit to give you some time, but I'm like, another part of me said, I can do it real fast. So
that was almost no time. A spit take, too.
What would you think?
I'm Lyle.
I'm Wayne. I mean, Wayne. Lyle, you almost done drinking there? No. Welcome back.
What's going on?
Well, yeah, maybe, I mean, you've only been receiving some of the text messages from Wayne, but
yeah, only some. Keyword there, some.
Man, yeah. I set my phone on fire, jeez.
But I've been also on the. I spend my lunch hours listening to Wayne rail against how a Game of Thrones has progressed.
Yeah.
In episodes 2 and 3.
I don't know. It's kind of a disappointment.
Well, you toned it way down.
Well, all right.
What was the last time? God, they fucked it all up.
Yeah, I believe.
I think your plan was to, when Martin dies, to carve "Raper of Dreams" on his gravestone.
I didn't say that. Yeah. I didn't say that. You extrapolated that. But, no, when Lyle was telling,
I never explicitly said what I was going to write on his gravestone. I just said something unflattering.
No, Lyle was telling one of our coworkers, and I believe the phrase, yeah, man, Chris was, or Wayne was slapping his head at the end of that episode. Man, because, in all fairness, I did.
You were.
Yeah, I was. I don't know. I think it was because, like, this was one of the things I was, like, really excited about. Like, the last time I was this excited about something was...
No.
Now, my birthdays have long since stopped being exciting, was the Star Wars prequels.
Yeah, so Phantom Menace.
Yeah, so Phantom Menace. You know, I was real excited to see that. You know,
and which has been a bigger letdown so far?
Probably Phantom Menace.
Probably.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
I think we were actually talking about this, and the thing with Phantom Menace is you walk out of the theater going, oh, I didn't like this. Should I have liked this?
Yeah,
I really
like
the Star Wars trilogy. Yeah, and this is, you know, before a lot of social networking took off and Twitter or blogs were relatively rare. What is this, 1999? 2000? Anyway.
Somewhere around there, I forget exactly.
So you didn't have like people just mailing you right away saying,
God, that sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're kind of in this little bubble. Like,
yeah, you're
maybe
in
it was only me who hated it.
And like, I'm
gosh, maybe that was an outstanding little actor. Maybe the Midichlorians was an interesting addition.
No, I don't think I ever thought that.
Yeah, you're just going to get me in rage mode again about something else, aren't you? But...
Yeah, I think I actually spent, like, obviously for anyone that listens to this podcast, I'm a big fan of Star Wars. But I spent a long time trying to find something to like about it. And, yeah. Nothing.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Game of Thrones.
Well, anyway, this is why I generally try not to get excited about stuff, because I always kind of get disappointed. But that being said, we've only seen up to the third episode. Episode 1 had a lot of promise, I think, as we discussed. But then I was just surprised at almost how immediately they departed from the script for episode 2. I don't know. Part of me hopes that episode 4 kind of...
What would it take to make episode 4 good for you again?
I don't know. I don't know what it would take to make it good. In all fairness, I probably just haven't accepted the fact that they're two different media.
Hmm. Right on.
It took me a while to get over that with like some other things. But
you were really upset that they dropped the Bran flashback where...
Yeah, or the Bran, the dream...
The flying...
With the
sorry, the dream.
The dream sequence with the three-eyed crow. Because I thought that was... I don't know. Again, maybe it's because I've read the whole series...
I really thought episode 3 it was going to end on a flashback.
Well, it was leading into a flashback.
It seemed to be, because when Stark's looking at Arya practicing with the sword, and he kind of gets that sad face, and I'm really hoping we're going to see the standoff with the three Night's Guard.
I'm totally hoping so.
I actually read it to the guys. They've read the book, but just read it again.
You did quite a good reading, I might say.
Thank you. Well, they lead into, a lot of times when they're cutting between scenes, they'll use sound to lead into the scene. Like the sound of the next scene will come up before it cuts. And that's kind of where it was going. So it's almost like they were telling you we're gonna cut to a battle scene here because all the swords are clashing, and then they cut to the end.
Yeah.
So like they primed us for something, just don't know what it is yet.
Yeah, I really would like to see that flashback, but I don't know if I need to see that flashback because I have the book.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, sure, I would think that like that's one of my favorite parts of the first book is that scene with the seven against three.
Yeah.
My other favorite part is the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Which should be in episode 4, and if it's not in 4, it should be in five. And so should the flashback, should be one of those. The flashback's actually after the tournament, but it's fine if they move it forward.
Yeah.
I don't know, I kind of talked to you before, Lyle. Like, would you come over to the dark side if they just completely cut out the tournament? Like, if the series didn't have the tournament at all,
well, they're going would you be more on my side? Of course.
Yeah, but...
They already talked about it in the meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you say that, but like they agree,
really
they set it
shot.
Up. But yeah, that might be all it is. It could be like the tournament happens off camera and you don't see it at all. Well, that's a possibility.
I guess.
I mean, Greg, there's been an image on the internet, and of course, when this episode airs, we already have the answer.
Yeah.
Right.
But of Gregor Clegane.
Right.
In full armor, the active art, the actor's cast, and they have a picture of him in full armor. So that suggests that they're not going to cut away, because his only real part in the first, like his significant part in the first book is...
The tournament.
Tournament. Actually, yeah, and he actually has a small part, although they don't name him, in the dream that they cut.
Yes.
With Jaime Lannister. And he's kind of just this mountainous, like the shadowy mountain man, which is the mountain that rides.
Yeah.
And someone who's all gold. Yeah, I was surprised, too, that they departed, so... Because I decided to read the book again. Just because, you know, you get excited.
Murdered, yeah,
you get in the mood, but also just because A Dance with Dragons is coming out in July. Mm. So that to be ready for that, so you're up to... You know, I can remember all the different plot hooks and where things ended.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I think I'm...
But yeah, surprised how things departed, but... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And then, yeah, you could, and certainly I would quibble over certain things that were cut. Like, oh, that line, you know, should have been you, John. I said that. Oh, that, to me, that showed the, in that one line, the relationship between John and
Lady Caitlin.
Yeah, Lady Caitlin. And they didn't cut that. So, oh, do people get it as much? Because they don't have that line. But I guess if Martin was happy with it. It was such a small thing that if he said, put his foot down and said, no, that line's got to stay.
Yeah.
I'm sure they would have had that, kept it in.
Yeah.
And some things they were quite faithful in the exchange between Joffrey. That's probably my biggest quibble is who they cast for Joffrey. I mean, he looks like a goblin.
Yeah, we both said that.
I don't think, I don't think he's a beautiful kid like they describe him in the book, but I wouldn't go quite as far as goblin.
Goblin.
said that...
If you want to say gargoyle, I'll concede.
I was thinking more hobgoblin.
Call him an imp, because that's Tyrion.
I want to take that back. Forget it.
Wait, you have a better one or something?
No, because he's just a kid.
Yeah. He'll grow into his goblin-y features, sure.
The point we both made...
All right, nice save. Thank you.
What we agreed on is the actor who plays Lancel should have played Joffrey.
Yeah. The guy, he was very pretty.
Yeah.
And perhaps... Actually, the actor himself could have been Lancel as well. They've just kind of like really prettied him up, and that beret maybe not. Hopefully they'll be gone next
beret,
time.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about that.
Hello. He looks like a girl, but yeah, he would have been good as Joffrey.
Yeah.
But we haven't really seen him act, though.
No.
Maybe the other kid's just a really good actor.
I don't know.
Who hasn't grown into his features yet.
Yes. His lips will pout yet.
I promised myself I wouldn't actually like call the guy a goblin on.
Had to like that.
Yeah.
I feel bad.
Well.
Not as bad as he does.
Fine, thespian. That little kid.
Anyway.
Cool.
So, long story short, I'm kind of hoping that episode 4 does something to kind of bring me back in.
Well, on the other side of it, like, I've enjoyed every episode so far. I'm really a fan of the series. But I suppose it helps that I haven't really read.
Yeah, you didn't finish it.
So, yeah. So maybe that's why I'm enjoying it. There's nothing for to be ruined for me.
Yeah.
I think the some of the child actors have actually improved characters. I was never a huge fan of Arya.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand her being a popular character, but she certainly wasn't my favorite.
Yeah.
But the actress that they chose has been fantastic, and I think has actually improved that character.
I wonder if I might not get more out of it watching the series first and then reading it afterwards, in that I'll have a face to put in the book.
I don't know.
That's probably safer, because you have... Then just Ned Stark will look like Sean Bean.
Yeah. And like Jaime Lannister will look like... Than the
yeah, exactly. TV and you go, oh, yeah, that gives that a little bit more depth. It probably is something that the series is better to watch first, then read the books.
Yeah.
Because I think sometimes when you read a book, you get a lot of ownership over characters. So I can't imagine Joffrey being one of those characters you have a lot of ownership over. But like, say, for example, a Jaime Lannister.
Yeah.
Where you do have an image in your mind and then...
How he sounds and everything.
Yeah, how he sounds, how he looks. And so then if the casting isn't exact, then you have a certain reluctance. But I will say that they've been dropping Jaime Lannister a lot in in episodes 2 and 3 just to have a steady presence.
I actually agree.
It seems to be every other scene. There he is, just sitting on the stairs.
Yeah.
Oh, you're trying to get by? Oh, let me move for you.
I'm Jaime Lannister, by the way.
Yeah.
Jaime Lannister.
They're definitely working him in, I guess, to justify hiring that actor, who they're going to need a lot in the subsequent seasons.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But also just to establish who this guy is, because he's not a point-of-view character in the first book. But, yeah, I understand that. And I think the way the guy portrays him, the personality, I think, is really good. So it'd be interesting to watch his transformation.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to, which I hope they keep in, is the Hound and Sansa Stark's first real exchange after the feast.
Kind of like you and I said, it seems like they're already making Jaime and the Hound more sympathetic than they were in the book. In the series, they're already kind of a bit more, well, not sympathetic, but a tad bit more likable.
Yeah, to find the other dimensions of Jaime in the first book, you really have to look, and probably, maybe it's just me, but in subsequent readings, you would find it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, they mentioned this about him. Oh, okay. Oh, he said that ruefully. So, therefore, I'm trying not to spoil anything.
I'm not getting anything out of what you're saying. Yeah. Sorry to say.
Okay, so maybe the listeners aren't getting anything out of it.
If you read the book, you probably know what we're talking about.
Mm. Yeah, but there's certain things you can drop in the book to hint at dimensions of a character that you have to be more explicit in and for the character. So I think they're doing that with Jaime and the Hound, I think, as well. But I would argue, or I did argue, but perhaps weekly, is that...
You never argue weekly.
I'm sure I made a short argument.
Sure.
That the Hound, I wonder if the Hound actually kind of grew on Martin as he was writing him. And there was one scene maybe he would have liked to have taken back. And that's the scene with the butcher boy. Mm-hmm. And I like the way they did that in the TV series. They kind of softened it.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's fine.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe it was even Martin's idea.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, could have been. But, I'm still really excited about episodes 4 or 5.
Like I said, I'm loving it.
So,
sorry, Wayne.
And we should tell the listeners, Wayne's going to be right next to us watching it, so not like he's...
Head slapping and all.
Screaming
the whole time. I might just storm out the door, depending on what happens.
I'm sure you'll go, one more episode.
Yeah. What, it's over? Oh, all
right. But we can actually credit Game of Thrones and Martin for this episode, because... we were talking, if you looked on the forums, anyone, Chris is thinking about... I don't know what to say to that. I was like...
Really? You were the guy I was talking to?
Yeah.
I never would have guessed it. It was the same Wayne.
Chris is already thinking about his restarting, or when he restarts the fantasy, just to basically poll us what we'd like to see. And not see in the fantasy game that was 4E D&D, with an undecided system. And I had said a Game of Thrones with fantastic locales and that. And we were talking about how to do that, how to make this fantasy game more like a Game of Thrones. Does it mean the political intrigue and that? Mm. But one of the things was how Martin just infuses history in the scenes.
Yeah,
and drops little things, and you just get a sense.
That the world is bigger than
bigger than what we're being shown. That it's real, you know, and things like that. So we decided to do an episode on giving your setting history, and as Wayne suggested, why don't we broaden that? Just giving it history, giving it a background, a flavor.
I'd say giving it life.
Giving it life. All right. Giving is that the word?
Yeah. But probably not. I just hit upon that now. But
yeah. All right.
Yeah. Giving it a history or a life outside of the player characters, because the player characters in any story, regardless of fantasy or whatever, are heroes, but that doesn't mean they're the only people doing stuff in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's fine for them to be the heroes of the story, but they should also be shown that other stuff is happening around them.
Or has happened.
Or has happened, yeah. Or will happen, if you want to go all three.
Yes.
I don't know how you would do that. Anyway, all right. Man, I just got a bunch of eye rolls there. All right.
Well, we're talking about history.
All right.
The history that will happen.
History of the future.
Yeah. Well, if you go the Wheel of Time cyclical history, what happened in the past is going to happen in the future again anyway.
Yeah, anyway.
Oh, did they make that up?
I don't know. That? Anyway, shut down.
Right. No, I think I've heard if you don't learn from history.
Stupid ancient Chinese philosophers taking that crap.
All right, doomed to repeat it.
All right, fine.
You never heard that before?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Willfully forgotten that.
Yeah, exactly. No, I choose to forget, sir.
Yeah, ask me again in 30 minutes, and I'll say I don't remember that still.
If I keep practicing that, I might make a good politician.
All right. So basically, we've kind of divided it into two. One is top-down, or macro, kind of approaching it in a macro way, and the other is bottom-up, or micro. Approaching it in a microwave.
Or from the bottom and working up, as some might say.
So we kind of...
All right, so let's get a definition, hey? What is top-down?
Yeah, so that'd be good. Oh, so, okay. Chris, if you want to...
Oh, well, then, all right. What is top-down? Well, I'm glad I asked. Top-down is top-down is where you design the broad world first, and then you get down into narrow details depending on where the characters are. So, for example, in the previous Dungeons & Dragons campaign we did, I started with all of the gods and their relationships and stories between them, and then kind of worked my way down into the different countries, and then down into the specific country that the players were in, and then down to the city where I had expected they were going to be spending all of their time. So I had kind of a broad idea of it, but the only part that was fleshed out was the city. Whereas the opposite would be bottom-up, where you create a small area where the characters would start, and you very much flesh that out, give it a lot of detail. And then as the players move along, you build up detail where they are, creating a world as you go along.
So that reminds me, I had a book for second edition D&D. It was called The World Builder's Guidebook.
I love that book.
That was a great book.
You still have it, though.
Yeah, I still have it. It's actually in my apartment now.
Yeah.
And it was kind of broken into chapters and at the beginning it said, okay, if you want to do the macro approach, follow this book through chronological order of chapters, like start with chapter 2 and go to chapter 10. I said, if you want to go the micro approach, just work from the back of the book and go forward.
Huh.
Because the first chapter was suggestions for like the actual shape of the planet and like if it had any celestial bodies around it. And then the next step was you could generate land masses and what percentage of the thing was of the planet was water. And you essentially, you could go all the way down into single cities.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all kinds of great, you know, charts and random tables where you could mix and match races and cultures and
cool.
And ideas and stuff. So if you went, if you went through one way, it was the macro approach. And if you went through the other way, it was the micro approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because I've never... Like, I kind of understand the philosophy there, but it doesn't... I see the micro approach as not really... not caring to build the world at large for it. You just kind of build what you have to. So it's kind of interesting that you think you would start small and then go all the way to the top.
Well, no, you didn't have to go all the way. No, you didn't have to go all the way up. But the last chapter was, how to build a city.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was, okay, well, the players have got to start somewhere, so you build a city. And then the next chapter back was sort of surrounding countryside and putting in terrain. So... you know, when they explored beyond the boundaries of those cities, you could just at home make a few quick rolls or choose something, and then you had the countryside around it.
Okay.
And things would still kind of make sense.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah, like, I don't know, reading some blogs online about it. They were saying that some of the pros and cons of them is, like, if you have the top-down approach, you have a really good feeling of where and what everything is. For example, if the players meet a merchant and they say, where have you come from? He says, well, I've traveled 3 days through the desert to get here. Mm. Like that. And you know it's 3 days because you know where he started from, you know where he finished. The problem is that the world sometimes seems to lack specific detail because you're designing such a large scope, you don't have time for specific NPCs that the characters might meet. Mm. Whereas the opposite, bottom-up, is you have a lot of detail. Everything is very fleshed out in the immediate area, but it also leaves the door open for loopholes. When you meet that merchant, you just make up on the fly, I walked 3 days through the desert. But if you forget to put in that desert 6 months down the line, things might look bad.
Yeah, so they're both have pros and cons.
Absolutely. Oh, how about you guys? Like, I favor top-down. And you?
Nah.
The way you said before, it sounds like bottom-up, though.
Yeah, I'm not. I guess I have a preference for bottom-up. My thing is, it doesn't really matter how little or how much history you have. Mm-hmm. If the players aren't going to learn it or know it. Mm-hmm. And I would say the danger of, like, writing pages and pages and pages of stuff the players aren't going to read or aren't going to realize is there, mm-hmm. is greater with the macro approach than with the micro approach. Because in the micro approach, you're thinking about your emphasis on what the players are going to see and what they're going to interact with. Mm-hmm. And what I would... So I kind of approach this episode is, like ideas, kind of a quick and easy way of giving it a history that could be nothing more than a name. So it's not only what the players see, but what the players hear.
Oh, can I interrupt there?
Absolutely.
That was the most civil interruption ever.
Shut up! No, I do...
I was reaching for my knife.
You mentioned before about using metagame to work for the game, which is really interesting that I want to hear. But before you know that, like, it's interesting you recommended, like, a Game of Thrones, which seems very top-down, because everywhere around has different history and has a lot of information
I don't know. I think it would be hard to
say one way or the other, because we're only seeing, like, the finished product.
Of course, we don't know how Martin designed it, but...
But that's also a novel. Mm-hmm. So not only does the first book also include a map, mm-hmm. it also... He controls all the information that you get.
Yeah.
And then if you look in the back of the book, there's an outline of the different houses, their mottos, and things like that. So you can always flip back and forth.
Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of world information, not just where you are immediately in the book. It seems like Martin built the world and then put the story through it.
I could be wrong, but I think like a lot of authors... There's that one thing, like, for example, with the road, I'm drawing a blank. What's his name, Cormie?
Oh, I don't know. I forget. Probably, I think McCormick sounds right.
McCormick for the road. Uh-huh. And he was just driving through Texas and saw, I don't know if he saw actual fires on the horizon, or maybe it's just the sun hit it and looked like there were fires on the horizon, mm-hmm. and that became the inspiration for the road. And I forget what Martin's is, but he was trying to write a science fiction book, and then there was, like, he had this one scene. Uh-huh. And from that scene became a Game of Thrones.
Okay.
But yeah, maybe then he went, okay, I've got the scene, and then... How do I fit it in? But I think Tolkien approaches it definitely from the macro, is where he basically wanted to have a story, the great simplification, just to have the Elvish language and the Elvish history.
Yeah, that's what I heard, too.
But just kind of gave it like a little fictional...
Make a story.
So people would read this. Whereas Martin, I think he's... kind of from his background, he would come in. This people are going to read this, and they're going to be. He wants to tell the story, and then I don't know if he then stopped telling the story to say, okay, let's get the history first, or if he kind of threw things in and said, that's good, I'll write a little bit about that.
It could be just so skilled that we don't realize. It just feels like a very rich world, but he's going as he goes, making it up as he goes along.
Well, I know he says the characters have kind of taken on a life of their own, and that's why he's. The original trilogy is now...
Seven books.
Yeah.
Or will be seven books.
But, but what I see in his hands, and that's why it became the inspiration for this episode, is how he can drop it in. And don't laugh, but George Lucas did the same thing with the original Star Wars.
Well, why would I laugh at that? Okay. I think that's a great example.
Where he said he wanted to throw out all these references, like the Clone Wars, and I don't know if they mentioned Mandalorian armor in the actual books or if they were in the comics, but he wanted to have all these different references. Mm-hmm. and different expressions like thank the maker.
Yeah.
And he just wanted to throw it at the audience, and they were like, what? What? And they wouldn't understand half of what was being said,
mm-hmm.
but it would give that world a history and
feeling
its own
reality.
Yeah, and its own feeling of reality. And I think both of those, if you look at Star Wars and you look at a Game of Thrones, they both have that. And just try to pick out little tricks,
mm-hmm.
Or at least pick out little tricks that a game master or a storyteller can use when they run a game.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good idea. But
so that's how I approach this episode. That's why when you guys were talking about top-down, bottom-up, I was like, yeah, okay, I'm not really sure. I guess bottom-up.
Okay.
I was going to say, I guess that's an easy, not maybe not an easy thing to do, but it's easy advice. But in like a movie or a novel where that's not interactive, right, the story doesn't stop when the audience goes, so what did he say? I don't get it, right? So I'm not saying that players will do that.
Yeah,
I'm just saying...
I suppose Luke never looked at C-3PO and says, thank the maker, what the hell are you
exactly.
talking about?
But like, if there are... I guess my advice would just not to go overboard with it, because if you have too many sayings or too many names or things that get dropped in that the players don't know, the game's going to grind to a halt. And then they say, what did you say?
I actually didn't list my tips, and you already have the criticism.
All right, sorry. It wasn't so much.
He's good.
It wasn't a criticism.
History of the future.
History of the future. Yeah, exactly. So it wasn't so much as a criticism as more of a be careful kind mm-hmm. of thing. You know, like I really like the idea, and it's a great idea. It's just, you know, experience being what it is, not only with you guys but with other people. Players tend to say they don't really let things go that they don't understand. They kind
players
of,
question.
Exactly.
And you got to have enough there to back up those questions.
Sorry.
I was thinking making the... Well, maybe I should say the ideas.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Then we can continue our criticism of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's just a formality.
Either way, I'm just going to go, sucks!
like, for example, like if you have place names that actually don't match the environment,
mm-hmm.
then players will question that.
Yeah.
So if you walk into a desert, but it's called Sweet River, and people are like, oh, mm. what river?
Mm.
And then that will, like, you could write pages and pages of the history of your world,
mm.
but people aren't going to have time to necessarily read it or the inclination to read it. But if they walk into Sweet River and it's a desert, they might go, why is it called Sweet River?
Yeah.
Oh, because of that catastrophe or that cataclysm, you know, a millennia ago.
Yeah.
And then, oh, yeah. So, or you call something, just to borrow from a Game of Thrones, you call something Seven Kingdoms, but there's actually only five. What happened to the other two kingdoms?
Yeah.
Like they kept the name, but then you're like, the players will go, what happened to the other two kingdoms? Oh, because this was taken over by this kingdom, and this one kind of just dropped off in an earthquake. I'm like, oh, okay, you know.
But
those are like little cheats, but of course, naturally, you're dropping it in, but you should have answers.
Mm-hmm.
But not long, drawn-out answers, but answers. And then the players, when the players are interested, then they'll question you on it. Like, why is that called Sweet River?
Yeah.
Would you... Do you have more points? Not to cut you off, but would you want... Sorry. Would you want...
What your point is.
No, would you want players to do that in or out of character?
Out of character is fine. I mean...
In.
But... Or... I think both are fine. I mean, if they're supposed to know about Sweet River
mm-hmm.
and know it's a desert, then out of character. If they're being shown this place for the first time and they're like, why... Then they could ask the NPC that led them there.
Yeah.
Or, what? This is a desert. Are we here? And then, I don't know. I find out. And then they have to go find somebody and say, oh, I noticed this place is called Sweet River, but... Or I noticed your tavern is called, you know, the King's Lands. Why is that?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, because he, you know, sired a bastard here. Get it, Lance?
Yeah.
All right.
and just hope that your players will actually question that.
Well, I would
But
sorry.
Yeah, sure, and maybe they won't question it.
Yeah.
But I mean you could throw in like little curses instead of saying, you know, oh my god or something like that, you know, like somebody says something similar on the septum or
on the thing of an example of that is Battlestar Galactica. Throwing in thank the gods, you know.
Thank the gods a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, frack. Of course, it was done for censorship purposes, but it's a word that really stands out, and it became so indicative of the series.
Use it so much.
Yeah, it is. But I thought that was really good. Is it kind of reminds you that this is not just a regular sci-fi. This is something different.
Hmm.
Yeah.
But also, one thing I'd like to say as a side is, like, when I create a campaign as well, I write lots of background for it, and a lot of it never gets seen or even questioned by the players, but that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. I still just enjoy writing it.
Oh, people are happy to do it. But I think then, well, once you write it, then think about, how am I going to introduce this?
Mm-hmm.
Because that will make the world more interesting for
That's
the
true.
Players.
And if you do get to introduce it, it feels so good, too,
yeah.
Instead of just having written it.
Yeah, I would...
Like, one thing we were talking about how to make the fantasy world more Game of Thrones,
mm-hmm.
is that there were all these different countries surrounding the primary kingdom of, or at least the where we spent our time, of Longblade's Peak.
Yeah.
We were exposed to some, I guess, prejudices against the Eladrin of mm-hmm. the world because of something in history, and that was explained. But mm-hmm. other things could have been explained, is what do people think about the halflings of Shireton,
yeah.
or what do
yeah.
people think about the people in the rocky villages
mm-hmm.
In the south?
Yeah,
and one idea was to give, and this is borrowed from the World of Darkness, and the first time I had seen it was in Vampire mm-hmm. Masquerade. Whereas all the clans have opinions, and they write like a little one line of their opinions of the other clans.
Yeah.
So not only do you get that big write-up of each clan, then you can look at what the other clans think of each other, plus what that clan thinks of the other clans.
Absolutely.
And I thought that could be used for the players to have different... This is what people in the south think of the elves in the north, or, mm-hmm. and this is what they think about on the kingdoms of... To the west of Longblade's Peak is the ocean, so maybe there's a kingdom across the ocean. And to the east, there's a lot of other different... kingdoms, so yeah. write, oh, people from such and such are like this. Yeah. Oh, those merchants from da-da-da-da.
And I think that's actually one of the best suggestions I've heard in a long time. That's really good, so I yeah. definitely want to use that.
And then players, and then also if you want players to contribute to the world building, which some storytellers don't,
mm-hmm.
Maybe as the story progresses, but not initially, and some do, is then they can write what they think. And if it doesn't really match your vision, mm-hmm. you can say, well, that's good, maybe that's what you think. But the people around you think this.
Yeah.
Like, you think the dwarves in Ironholm are fantastic. Mm-hmm. And that. But
Everyone
actually...
thinks they're grubby little
Actually,
thieves.
You know, 300 years ago, they enslaved you guys.
So. Yeah.
Like, oh, why do I like them? I don't know. I don't know. So
you tell me.
Okay. So that was one way of basically filtering it piecemeal to the players.
Yeah.
Your history.
Hmm. I think that's a pretty good idea.
You were talking about something that was very micro, and that was one of the reasons why you wanted to expand it to background Wayne.
Yours is almost micro and macro Wayne, because you do like micro level detail, but you do it for everything.
Yeah, I know.
You write books.
Yeah, I know, which then never get used. But it's because I have a lot of spare time, I guess. But
like the little tower.
Yeah, this was an example. On another podcast, and the basic point was to make the players feel like they're part of a real world. Some things,
from the dungeon
world. Yeah. Some things
good.
Shouldn't be explained.
Hello, guys.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for that.
Listen
idea.
To you. Please good. Listen to us.
Yeah. Basically, there should be like not inconsistencies, but sort of little mysteries or events or locations that sort of don't connect to the main story. And never really get explained mm-hmm. to the players. And I guess it could turn into a sidetrack or a sidetrack if the players go off in that direction.
Yeah.
But doing things like that, because it makes it feel like the world is real, because in real life, not everything revolves around the... You know, you.
Well, absolutely. Right? And I think that goes in with what Wyla was saying as well, that, you know, it's like the Game of Thrones. There is this history there. Hmm. Like, if you happen to touch it, then you get to see it. Otherwise,
yeah. I think the example. Sorry to cut you off, Love.
Yeah, no,
example,
I mean you brought that up, and it was I thought that was great. But it immediately made me think of in the Fellowship of the Ring, both the book and the movie, where they're on the river, and there's the statue of the two kings.
Yeah.
And they also, I'm just drawing a blank. They also find that other statue where the goblin, or sorry, the orcs. Chop the head off. But, like, you know, the statues of... And in that case, they weren't forgotten kings, because Boromir and Aragorn knew who they were.
Mm-hmm.
But they just kind of say it, and you're like, oh, okay. And you move on.
Yeah.
I was actually thinking, sorry.
But it was great, because you could also have statues where people just don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe it looks human, maybe it doesn't look human.
That statue has four toes.
Oh, if you look at, think about Lost, and it's like, don't explain it.
You know? Ever.
don't explain anything. I thought you were going to go a different way with season two.
I'm trying to finish up the season six now, but.
Yeah.
That doesn't hold any interest for me. But I was actually thinking in the Lord of the Rings movie, at the beginning, they actually camp under those three stone trolls.
Yep.
And unless you've read, you know, the Hobbit, you don't know where those trolls came from. They don't say anything about them. They're just there, and, you know, it's not something that they pursue. So just another way to make things seem larger than the people in the story.
Yeah, and in a movie, you can't question that. But, in a game, your players will be like, stone trolls.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, I don't... You could even say, there's no one knows why they're there. They've been there for, 100 years. Mm. And then they're like, oh, okay. And it doesn't matter. Because then they're like, okay, something else happened. Mm-hmm. We're not the only people moving through the world. Somebody else defeated these three stone trolls.
Yeah, and you kind of hope the players get that rather than saying... Are there any tracks around? Let's try and find out who turned these trolls to stone. I'm going to dig a hole for 5 hours.
Well, then, you might then, you know, put moss on the stone trolls.
Yeah,
Clearly, they've been here for
a... That won't stop players. There might be gold inside them.
Then don't give them tracks. I don't know. Anyway. But little things like that. And you mentioned about the metagame.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
I wanted to hear this.
A master of the meta, not the meta game, but basically this is borrowed from originally Robert E. Howard, and George R. R. Martin actually does it as well, is they take like real historical events, then maybe change the names, change the characters. Mm-hmm. So Game of Thrones, The War of the Roses,
mm-hmm.
was a major inspiration. And if from Howard, like the Conan Hyboria, he basically takes like kind of prehistoric Europe.
Yeah,
and only changes the names a little, or doesn't change the names. So you got the Picts, mm-hmm. and that was done to avoid like historical anachronisms.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, if you think about it in a game, if you take a thinly disguised historical, like historical event or historical world, mm-hmm. like let's say ancient Rome, so not necessarily a specific event in ancient Rome.
Yeah.
Then the metagame is actually going to work for you as a storyteller, because the players are automatically then thinking, oh, Rome has this, mm-hmm. and they're actually populating the world for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're not going to get the wow, he's so creative kudos,
mm-hmm.
That you would if it was completely original. But you know, how many original ideas are left? But the players are then going to. It's quick, you know, just a quick and dirty setting. But you know, the players are immediately going to give this world a lot more history than you have to map out.
Mm. Yeah. How do you guys feel about having the players create that world? Like, for example, if they walk into a marketplace, maybe you can just kind of give an overview skin of it and then say, tell me, what do you see?
That's fine, but like we discussed in Sands of Twine, mm-hmm. talking about a danger of a sandbox campaign,
mm.
is you don't want to make the players spend too much work mm-hmm. Providing it. I mean, it's great because they're collaborating, therefore they're going to remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've actually created it. It's like when you write something down or create something, you're going to remember it if somebody told you.
Right.
But then on the other hand, it's like, well, this is your world. Like, yeah. am I, and just like in the sandbox, am I writing the story for you?
Hmm.
I thought we were playing in your story.
Well, how was it for you guys, like in my last campaign? Like for the Aladdin, I said, you tell me. Whenever I had a question about the Aladdin, I'd ask you first.
Oh, I really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff I wrote as a player, creating for these Aladrin that I either didn't mention or forgot I mentioned, like the horsemen, the knights that were going slow.
Face-stepping cavalry?
Yeah, the face-stepping cavalry that would go insane because they're face-stepping too much mass.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, my character had a brother and that. You know, that was interesting for me. I don't know how interesting. I don't know how much I was contributing to the world for the other players.
Mm-hmm.
But I really enjoyed that. But some players, I think, might, you know, I don't really have much to give.
Mm.
Yeah, I think it's not a little bit like a cop-up, but it depends a lot on the type of player.
Yeah.
Because, some people will...
And to piggyback on that point, it also depends how often you're doing it.
Yeah.
Because for me, it was very strictly that part of the world, and it wasn't like I would walk somewhere else and he goes, yeah, well, what do you think about the Temple of Bane? Well, what do you think they do? That you had an idea what they did and their motivations. So, yeah. For me, it was very strictly compartmentalized.
Now that you've said that, Lyle, I think that's a good kind of tip if storytellers want to do that. Like, for example, your character was an Eladrin, my character was from this country.
Mm-hmm. To be honest, I don't know where.
Yeah,
I can't remember.
I think it was called Terrace. But anyway, the point is, Chris, you as a storyteller, you limited your questions to things our characters would know, such as when a question about the Eladrin came up, you turned to Lyle and said, what is it about the Eladrin? Or, not that it came up that often, but like with me, it was like, okay, well, what is Terrace like? Mm-hmm. And if you keep it something that's sort of only about the character, mm-hmm. That would probably be a lot better than just opening it up to everything, like going to the market. Oh, what do you see? I don't know.
Yeah, unless you were like a merchant or you grew up in the city. So you're like such and such character grew up in this city. So tell them about the marketplace. Then it's like, oh, that's my hometown.
Okay.
Also, if you have a secretive character, and we did have a secret, well, we always end up having a secretive
character. Sure, not a secretive character, a type of character.
A secret player.
But that's not unique to any group. There's always like, you know, that's a classic archetype. The person that, you know, wants to be secretive for
whatever reason.
For ominous reasons or not. But then it's like, tell me about I travel a lot. And you're like, oh, okay. All right. Well, tell us about your travels. Secret. Yeah. Okay.
You're actually really doing a good impression there.
I just think some people are better at running with improv than others. Like, I'm not one who is good at running with improv. I say that even though I improv about half of each changeling session I did. But not just because you guys always would go off in different directions, but kind of like whenever someone would put me on the spot as a character and say, well, what do you know about that? I would kind of freeze it. Like, only because...
It's interesting, actually. I was pretty surprised by that, because you've had a lot of creative stuff, but...
That's because I think back to what you said, the way I design... Sorry, not to cut you off. The way I design my stuff is, I read a lot of detail, so I'm kind of like a stickler.
But you need the time.
But I need the time, but then whenever you would say something, I would say, will what I... say screw up something Chris has planned.
Oh.
Or will what I say,
don't worry about that.
What run contrary to what the storyteller has set up? And
but you know, prejudices exist. I mean, I'm not saying anything terribly profound, but it is. So why not have that in the story? That gives it history. You're like, the halflings are all thieving whatevers, and that's not true. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that person is like, wow, they're the noblest, town around.
The noblest small people I know. Yeah.
I was really regretting using that as an example when I started. But maybe you say something that does contradict, because that's what people from your land think. Mm-hmm. Maybe you guys, maybe it's about your land that you're saying, and everybody's like, yeah, what about, we're a free people and everybody has equal rights. You're like, you've got slaves. Mm-hmm. So it could be like the 300 where Frank Miller rewrote history and had the Spartans... as champions of democracy.
Well, those people weren't people.
Now, there you go. Yeah, there you go. And then it could be a little back and forth. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with, people have different... They view the exact same thing, but they have a different impression of it. And that's fine.
Cool.
So I see that as less of a danger as you wait. But yeah, there could be a potential. You could say something that's completely off the mark. We have guns. And you're like, what?
Yeah, I think, because you always do, talking about archetypes, you always do have those players.
They've mastered space travel, of course.
Yeah, you always do have those players.
Actually, that's not the moon goddess. Actually, that's just a lump of stone. We've been there.
Yeah.
Really?
Like your latter thing, you guys don't have calculus yet?
Yeah. That's kind of funny. But I was going to say, you always kind of have the player where... I don't know, they always kind of run contrary. You're like, oh, is this there? And you're like, medieval fantasy Europe. No, we don't have giant mecha suits. Sorry.
Yeah, but I mean, if it was that extreme, then you just have a problem playing. So, Chris, you say that you love to do the macro.
I do.
All right. Basically, you've written this cosmology and the entire world, or at least the continent. Mm-hmm. How do you give that to the players? How do you let them... appreciate what you've what you've developed.
Well, that was actually one of the dangers of doing macro that I wanted to mention before and forgot about, is doing too much information. Like, when the players go into a certain location, it's like, oh, yeah, I've got a good story about this one. And you just start going on and on and on. I think more than once during the last campaign, you guys just kind of start, yeah, okay, get on with it. But, yeah, I guess...
That probably only happened when combat started.
No, probably because I always go, why didn't you tell me there was a giant troll there?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. Table, chairs, and...
Yeah, the room...
And why didn't you tell me people were sitting in those chairs?
Yeah.
Why don't you start with the people?
Yeah, he didn't just do that for you, just an aside here, because he doesn't just do it for you.
I was pointing the finger at myself.
Now, the... what was I saying? Yeah, I don't know. It's a really tough balance because I find like when I do NPCs that I like to write out a paragraph of what they want to say. That I'm much better at portraying the NPCs that way, but it doesn't seem to work when I do locations or items or something. I
find dialogue somewhere, writing out dialogues. Yeah. I do the same thing and it's like, you want to talk about that? All right.
Yeah, I did too at first. I would almost write out scripts, and then like people wouldn't say the right thing, and I'm like, all right, time to ad lib.
But I never try to do a dialogue, just one paragraph.
No, I'm just thinking like the topic isn't even the same.
Yeah, like what are you going to talk about? Oh, the one thing we told him not to talk about. Oh,
we decided to murder the king. I'm the baker.
I was going to say you did something. And you too, Lol, even though it was slightly different. I guess a good way...
And yours was sucked.
No, it was different, right? Since I got lambasted for talking about the future. Yeah, anyway. So,
how dare you?
Yeah. No, a way to show history is like you did with flashbacks, like you did part of the campaign was,
that was
a flashback.
Yeah, that
and
was fun.
Because we had gone to a specific location that you had obviously built up a history for this location, which we had heard a little bit about through NPCs. And then... There was actually a flashback scene where we became characters in that location and kind of acted out some of the history that happened there.
Yeah.
And I think that's an excellent way to show history for a location or show backstory for a location. And again, on a different podcast, I forget which one, other people have even suggested possibly using a different system for that. Just to make
do
it...
Do the flashback in a different system?
Yeah, do the flashback in a different system.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that.
I wasn't saying it was good or bad. I'm just saying
it's a great literary device or cinematic device. But it is very hard to do, and I think it was done well.
Thank you.
In yours, but it was. It can't be done too often because then you get into the, and you all have a dream.
Yeah.
Because how else do the players know that information? I guess you could do it if it was a very historical. In this particular thing, it was something that happened in secret, so it wasn't like historically known.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you can reenact a major historical event that everybody is supposed to know about.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that would be one way to do it.
Another way, you could actually do it if you want to give your party a little history. You could reenact how they met.
Mm. Definitely.
That might be a nice break if the campaign maybe hits a lull or whatever. And it's like, all right, remember how we met? Like, just sit in the tavern and then you talk about how you met.
The best way, I think, to give expose of things is through NPCs.
Yeah.
I think with the D&D campaign where you met the Elvish prince and the elves hate the Eladrin because they betrayed them eons ago. So like you went up and like, hey, how you doing? And the guy's like, get away from me. And that worked out well.
Mm-hmm.
So that caused you to look further into it. So
that can be difficult sometimes though, because
it worked there because it was one sided.
Mm-hmm.
Because one side didn't know the other side hated them and actually didn't care that they hated them. But yeah, were you going to say, like, you don't want to put somebody on the back foot? Or?
Well, no, you don't want to really... Yeah, I guess you don't want to put someone on the back foot
all the time.
No, I mean, if it's something that they should have known, and they're like, hey, how's it going? And it's like, why are you talking to me, slaver?
I was thinking eventually...
But if it's, like, one-sided, but maybe...
But if it's going to be common knowledge, you can't spring that on somebody.
Yeah.
You have to give that to them beforehand.
I was thinking it could just... You don't want the story to turn into, like, a long... A string of NPCs who, you know, soliloquize the relevant information to the players. Which
you don't want every NPC to be a dump,
right? Exactly, an information dump.
You should treat them as hooks. Have them mention something about a location or about a time, or like Lyle said, a curse word or a saying, like thank the maker. And if the PCs are interested in that, then they'll go to it, and there you go. They will ask the questions to allow you to give that information out.
I found players aren't usually that interested.
But... And if they're not, then is it really worth giving it to them?
Well, the answer is no.
But, I mean, some of it's just done for flavor. For example, thank the maker. You don't want to have your Star Wars campaign derailed as they go and look for the droid maker.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And look into droid cosmology if you didn't, like, develop that.
Or you don't want it to go off the rails and, like, who's the maker? Yeah, well, why did you say that?
Question.
Yeah.
So something like the curse is probably is more flavor than mm-hmm. anything. But, if you are going to introduce, if, like, there happens to be, you know, you go into a grove and it's got these weird trees. Oh, yes, this is from a Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And that's where they worship. Then, yeah, you probably do want to ask them to ask some questions about it if they don't know. Because that might... Religion generally plays an important role, at least in fantasy games. Mm-hmm. Less so in modern games, unless people make a real effort, concerted effort to do so.
Yeah.
I was going to say, another way to use the flashbacks is... recent history. So something that only happened like a couple weeks ago or even like a day before, you could have the players play characters in that situation.
Flash sideways.
Well, yeah, sort of a flash sideways. And then when their characters go to that location, they meet the NPCs, or they meet the characters who they had played in the flashback.
I don't know. That's kind of sticky.
That's the danger we talked about with the flashback. Are they supposed to know this information or not?
Well, the thing is, that would be for a situation where the player character are supposed to find out about something. Like, if there was a recent attack, then sort of people who survive the battle when you play it are the people who... the player characters meet when they go travel there.
I agree that it's a good thing, but there's a caveat to it in that you won't be able to surprise or give a really good reaction from the players for that because they've already seen it. They'll go there and they'll say, and people, the place will be burned down, and people will be like, oh, there was a horrible battle here. And they're like, oh, yeah.
Let's search around the building, see if we find anything.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah. But that's true. I wasn't
saying it's not a bad thing, but.
I wasn't thinking so much as it being a surprise, just it being a bit like a way to draw the players into the story, right?
Well,
they went through that situation's NPCs, like they saw how horrible or how wonderful or whatever this thing was. They played that. They just might be a little bit more invested in that hook than if they just go there.
It's a good way to convey maybe
import
news.
Yeah, okay.
Like news that they may have heard about. So like they're off doing something on one side of the city, but something else important was happening on the other side. And you could say, oh, by the way, while you guys are doing that, this NPC tells you blah, 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 blah. You could do that. Or you could actually have them do the event because this is going to be common knowledge. It's so big.
Right.
It is going to be common knowledge. A easy example might be, they're exploring some caves, but in the city there's a massive tournament.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you can then take a nice break from the
Dungeon Delve.
The Dungeon Delve, and then they do the tournament. So when they get back to the city, everybody's talking about this tournament. So all it is kind of just simulating.
Yeah.
And they talk about the tournament, and you're like, oh, yeah, we know the tournament.
There's a couple of things I'm planning to do for the upcoming campaign that kind of go to this. I'm planning on bringing you guys to a new city that you haven't been to before. At some point, I'm hoping you go there anyway. But I'm planning that there'll be a festival going on right when you get in town. And I want to just, because it's going to be pretty different from what you've seen before, so I just want to dump the culture on you with there. Like, there's all kinds of different festivities and things going on that you might not be familiar with. So that's one way to get to give some exposition there. And also, I'm planning to start the campaign with a kind of a flash sideways as well, another one. But it's actually not going to have any relation to the characters at all.
Well, now I just feel cheated because I know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. You told us now. I'm just going to start with a flash sideways. All right, fine.
Don't worry. You'll know that it's a flash sideways when you start because you're not your character.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, my character.
That is the tip off. All right.
Sitting over in a corner with a shredder. So yeah. But anyway, we'll see how that goes. We'll review it on the podcast later, so I hope.
Sucked.
You know that thing we did, what we called the wasted 4 hours?
Oh.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. So, Wayne, I've said before, I'm not a macro micro. What would you say that you are?
I've said that you are macro, or a micro rather.
Wow.
So I've never said I may be. It's been said of me. There's legends. Lyle the micro. Oh, that's
Lyle the micro.
That's what she said.
Micro Lyle.
I accept that habit of stereotyping. I'm a systemist.
But it's like, you know, in Robin Hood when they call him Little John. Not because he's little.
Not where you know. I guess.
And I'm glad.
It depends if it's his friend or his wife that came up with that nickname.
A version of Robin Hood were you reading?
Anyway, I guess I would be macro, probably.
Sorry, just thinking about Wayne's version of Robin Hood. There's a lot of Frankie Goes to Hollywood in the Sherwood Forest.
All right.
Frankie Goes to Robin Hood.
All right. Wouldn't it be Frankie Goes to Sherwood Forest?
Anyway.
I guess it would be macro.
Okay.
More.
In what way?
In that, I don't know, I always try and start micro, because in the past I know, okay, the characters aren't going to get to this, there's no point, or very little point in writing, you know, reams and reams of notes that they're not going to get to, but things always...
Despite writing reams of things.
Because things always kind of get away from me. Hmm. You know, I always try and start small and only worry about the things that the players are going to immediately interact with. And then my notes usually just sort of spiral out of control and I end up doing macro anyway.
You know, I get a feeling that you really like Ball of Twine campaigns, but you never actually run them.
It might seem that way only because I generally have tried to plan for all the possible outcomes that the players can come up with.
Okay.
Which always falls flat on its face because they always just go, well, how about there? And I go, shit, that's the one thing, that's one of the things I didn't plan for. Mm. So that's why I always end up with a lot of notes, which is why I guess I end up being macro.
Okay.
Because I just come up with sort of so many different directions that I anticipate the players possibly going that it all just kind of coalesces into a larger picture anyway, even though I always intend to start out from the micro approach.
Okay. Do you enjoy doing that?
Yes and no. Because, well, on the one hand, it gets kind of tedious trying to come up with things, but then on the other hand, it's nice to have notes for when they do go off on the way you haven't expected. You at least have some kind of framework. Mm-hmm. Like in the Changeling game that we played, like I had set up times where people would be at certain places where I said, oh, this person works in this strip club, this person works in this homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. Their working hours are from X to Y, and then after that they're generally here.
I kind of like to do a bit of downtime, though.
Well, I guess yes, in that when you guys... Well, I thought you would go one way, and you ended up going another way, but then you sort of came back, and you said, hey, let's go find the bishop again. Mm-hmm. And because I had written those notes, I said, okay, what time is it? It's this time. He'll probably be here. And so it wasn't really wasted, because you guys ended up using it anyway. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of, if I hadn't done that, I guess I just could have ad-libbed it, but I just like to have a framework that I could work with.
Yeah, which ain't a bad thing at all. No.
Yeah, I don't know, giving history for dummies kind of thing.
I think that's the title for the episode.
I already got one.
Oh, All right.
History for dummies it is.
No,
yeah,
no,
that's
no,
insulting.
I didn't say. I could even see, like, you know, like writing kind of one-liners on slips of paper and giving them to different people so that they have different ideas about the same thing.
Let them write their own.
Yeah.
Or let them write their own. Yeah.
Oh, definitely conflicting ones would be good. The slips of paper, though, I'm just thinking when you carry stuff, better to have them all on one sheet of paper.
Mm. Especially if you play at other people's house and you leave your notes around afterwards.
Or if you don't carry your notes.
Because all the little slips of paper I get from games, they always like fall out of my my little plastic sleeve.
Yeah.
And then, you know, picking up like, oh, what's this? Oh, that's that dream scene.
Yeah, I was just about to say. Yeah.
I had.
I should have just given you guys the envelope.
Oh, but even then, it's an envelope. It'll fall.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I definitely, obviously, giving a setting a history, I think I guess my big piece of advice is it's not really important what history it is. It's whether or how much you've done. It's how much you're letting the players know.
Hmm.
And how you're parceling out that information.
Yeah, how you're showing them.
because, yeah, it's great. I love writing stuff too, but sometimes it can be quite frustrating if you've written this really elaborate story behind point X and they don't care.
Yeah. And the thing I'd add to that is that is add hooks. Give their little pieces of nuggets. Little,
wow. Little would that be what nuggets?
Nuggios.
Little quirks.
It's little nuggets of information that you can put in the player's path that they so that they can pick those up and see, and then you can give some of that history that you've given the work into.
And that's a good point. So it probably should be even more explicit. Is like, yeah, the more you start tying your players to the history right away, and as the story goes along, the adventure goes along, the more that they're going to be invested in it.
Absolutely.
And the more that they'll be picking up. So
I would say maybe almost similar to the
It could even get to the point where you see the statues of forgotten kings, and the other players are like, oh, I don't know who that is. And then one just pipes up and he goes, no, what are you talking about? That's King Randor. Baelor. And the other's King Baelor. There you go.
Yeah, quick fantasy tip. End names and or to give that fantasy flavor.
Quick, boring fantasy flavor.
Yeah. So anyway, I was going to say, similar to how like a story structure has to be a little bit railroady at the beginning, rather than before it opens up.
No, I understand.
Maybe you would even want to sort of feed information to the players at the beginning when they're still trying to get their feet. For example, you could turn to a player and say, you know X. Right? Because sometimes the player might say, like if the storyteller is trying to be open, say, oh, what do you know about, you know, the palace?
Mm-hmm.
And the player might freeze and be like, so, you know, those kind of players, it might help to say, oh, you know, it was built by such and such.
John Orr.
Yeah, John Orr. John Orr. Ended in Orr.
Bob Orr.
Yep.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, sometimes your descriptions might have to be a little bit more
heavy-handed than open.
Well, I was thinking heavy-handed, maybe just a touch longer than it would later on, because you could say that the palace built by such and such the builder. I got to get a Game of Thrones.
Why don't we just rip stuff in Game of Thrones? Yeah, could his name have to be Brandon?
I drew a blank. Okay. The Mason, there you go.
The Mason.
You know.
Or
the other one, Mr. Beast. No?
All right. I was trying to help you out with that, Mr. Beast. All right. That's what really hurts.
All right.
That's what really hurts.
I'm sorry.
But yeah, you could say the castle written by Pycelle the Mason, who is the hero of the land from 300 years ago or 400 years ago. You could also then introduce your prejudices. Oh, it's when you introduce NPCs and you say, oh, give the racial prejudice, or you could give, if it's a famous enough NPC, a particular a positive or negative impression that most people have of this person. And that's instead of just making role, what's your reaction to this person?
Mm.
Like a social role, you're saying this is the oppressor of the little people or something. Mm. Yes, I know that's not very original sounding.
I
was getting the looks.
I was looking at my book. I didn't look at you.
On the knife twist to my back.
I have two knives.
Well, now that we've made history with this episode, I think we'll wrap it up before I get punched making that joke.
You give me crap for the puns.
But thanks for listening, and we hope to see you next week. Why did I return to see you next week?
I don't know. It's just funny.
Cool. See you then, guys. Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks.
Bye.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.